jazz.
Are we ready?
As right as we're gonna be, you're gonna be carrying more weight this week. So
okay, well, welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 117. It's the all Midwestern edition. We're all here in the Midwest, and in my case, it's Shante powered. I don't know about you. I'm Pat.
I'm like, what is that? What did you say? Powered?
Shante?
Chianti.
Oh my! Of course, I knew whatever it was.
You just do that on purpose. You know, when you're not online, you walk around and you speak absolutely perfectly fluent French and Italian and Mandarin. But when you get on the podcast, you act like a bumpkin. But in fact, you are like the James Bond of languages, aren't you? You're just like faking it on the podcast so everyone thinks you're relatable and goofy and Midwestern. But it's not true.
I am the James Bond of languages. I fuck them and then they're murdered by a supervillain. Yeah, that's what happens to languages when I get near them.
Shanti. Okay, cool.
All right. Now that I've been ritually mocked.
Hey, listen. You sent me a box set of John Denver, so I owe you for decades. Don't even start.
You do. And, you know, payback could be great. You know, thank you cards, exotic dancers.
That is not the standard thank you for a brick of John Denver. The brick of something else is normally the payback.
You know, I get this weekly or biweekly email from Music Aficionado, which I think began its life as thinking it was going to be kind of a large tent music appreciation site that's kind of gathering up articles from here and yon, but it's definitely laser focused now on music of the 60s and 70s. Clearly that's their audience. The people that want to read about this are, it's all classic rock. And they recently had an article on how John Denver's an underrated guitarist and musician.
All right.
I'll send you that link and then you will appreciate every disc in that set.
Okay.
Could have been a weather report. Cheer up.
I am so cheered.
Yeah. So anyway, today we are going to focus on a musician who passed away recently, Arthur Blythe, a man who was born in 1940 and died this March 27th, pretty recently, but whose active career really had come to an end before that, really by the 2004 or 5, he was kind of done recording. One reason he's remembered is he was probably Columbia's last major left field hire before they turned to the dark side of neoclassicism and went Marsalis and the Young Lions. So he comes on board with Columbia in 1978. And of course, by 1981, Wynton Marsalis's first release comes out. And Wynton is 21 years younger and starts to take up all the oxygen of that major label. But for a little while there, they were looking at kind of artists who were interested in combining some of the avant-garde lessons learned in the 70s with an appreciation for jazz history, and particularly, I'd say, jazz history that was not focused on bebop and hard bop, music that historical sense that went back behind those musics and looked at earlier forms as well as looking at the more radical 70s forms. And Blythe is certainly one of the avatars of this. David Murray, who as far as I know never made an album for Columbia, which must be the only label he hasn't made a label or an album for, is another one that we talked about at length a while back. So I thought it'd be good to do a show on him. He's very much a jazz musician of our generation. I don't know how much you've listened to him, though, and it sounds like you've only been able to do some prep for today. So,
Although, you know, I'm skimming over his discography. I realize that I have more familiarity with him than I expected. You've introduced me to him quite some time back. Yeah, I've listened to him in a couple of other places. So I've had Jack DeJohnette's special edition on the ECM label for some time.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good Jack DeJohnette album, and he's on that. And I didn't remember that he was on that. And of course, I have him on the Gil Evans Priestess album. And then a couple of at least one Chico Freeman album. He's on Focus. And I think I have one or two other things somewhere. I have Music Revelation Ensembles in the Name Of, but I couldn't tell you anything about it. I don't remember it at all.
Oh, if you do, send it to me, man. I've been wanting that album for years.
I'll have to dig. I think it's in a box, actually. It's a disc in a box that never got unpacked, but I do seem to recall having that.
Okay, and then that's a James Blood Ulmer joint, the guitar player, right?
Right. That's why it's on the DIW. Yeah, so I you had connected me some time back with some other stuff, Bush Baby and Lenox Avenue Breakdown and other stuff. So yeah, so I'm not utterly unfamiliar with him, but I have to admit he's not a player that I immediately, like, I hear and I go, that's Arthur Blythe.
Okay.
So, and you maybe could say more about what makes him distinctive or particularly special, that what kind of makes him stand out. I will say that he likes to play with Bob Stewart on tuba, and that's always a good thing. I can't get enough tuba, so.
Yeah, Bush Baby, which is an album he releases pretty much right before he joins up with Columbia, is a trio with tuba, alto saxophone, and is it cello or guitar? Anyway, it's a very minimalist setup.
If it's Abdul Wadud, it's a cello.
Okay. And so you can imagine, a very distinctive instrumentation there. And his best known album from the Columbia years, Lenox Avenue Breakdown, also features tuba, as well as Cecil McBee on bass, James Newton on flute, James Blood Ulmer on guitar. So it's quite the ensemble. But much of his career on Columbia and elsewhere, he works with pretty small ensembles, and he's rarely in a traditional front line with, say, a trumpet or a trombone. There are exceptions, but he doesn't, as a group leader, he doesn't tend to have another wind as the lead instrument with, and even Newton's a little unusual, right? The alto sax flute pairing is not a typical one. Certainly when I was a kid reading about him, the narrative seemed to be that he signs to Columbia, he makes his masterpiece, Lenox Avenue Breakdown, and then they're so horrified by Put Sunshine in It, which is towards the very end of his tenure, which was pretty commercial, that they just tend to write it as a narrative of kind of dwindling production and dwindling success, that it was a great record and then it all kind of went downhill. And I my feeling has been, as I've really, where I've gathered up his Columbia stuff, and I don't have all of it, I've got about half now, has been in used record stores in the last few years. I did not have it on disc, and indeed it's been completely out of print on CD for many years, except for Lenox Avenue Breakdown. And I think recently I've seen in Amazon a kind of 4 records on 2 CDs set that came out of Europe somewhere that has Lenox Avenue Breakdown and 3 of his other recordings on Columbia. So somebody is now, I guess, with copyright situation, or maybe they've got some kind of deal with Columbia or Sony issuing some of that stuff. But yeah, to some degree, like Paquito de Rivera or James Blood Ulmer, anybody who's not named Winton on Columbia from the 70s and 80s, or named Dexter Gordon, they've kind of let that catalog go out of print. Hmm. So he's a little hard to track down now. And really, I'd say out of the 9 albums, the ones I've heard, they've all been successful. I haven't heard any ones that I think are just wrong-headed. I now kind of want to hear Put Sunshine in It just to find out what goes on, because there's certain things about him as a player that I think wouldn't necessarily be a bad fit for a more Hank Crawford or David Sanborn-style recording. So we're going to get started with a recording he made back in 1969 with Horace Tapscott, the piano player. We've talked about Horace before, and this was apparently the first commercial recording Horace made, and he was so upset that he was not allowed to be consulted on the mixing of it that he didn't record again commercially for 10 years. Horace was a very independent-minded guy out in California. He led kind of a community-based group. There's a whole book on this called The Dark Tree, and one of the major players in that was Arthur Blythe. But Blythe, by the mid-70s, is a little bit frustrated with the limited opportunities to kind of make it as a jazz musician in California. And so he goes over to New York. So yeah, we talked about thoughts of Dar el Salaam back on episode 36. Let's begin with your thoughts about The Giant Has Awakened. And this is back in the period when he's working with Horace Tapscott that he was called Black Arthur. He was both a fine alto saxophone player, but also someone who was very aware of his ethnic heritage and black history and was very eager to promote it and was, you know, happy to identify himself in that way. So I have a feeling The Giant Is Awakened might have some kind of political subtext in terms of a title. Just thinking about it, maybe. I don't know. It's a four-tune set, very intense, in the Tapscott matter of kind of a pounding modalism, and it features Blythe extensively. He is the one horn. So thoughts on that particular recording?
I think it's a pretty inspired pairing in the sense that Tapscott is a sort of brooding, pounding presence. He's the kind of player that the word that comes to mind most often for me with Tapscott is power. He's just a powerful player, and calling the album The Giant Is Awakened, it may have some political or racial subtext, but to me, Tapscott is just a monster player. And it's not that he's got, you know, this sort of lickety-split crazy runs or anything. There's just a kind of intensity and presence about his playing. You know, he seems serious without being po-faced and powerful, just powerful, powerful player. And Blythe's playing with him strikes me as it's an inspired pairing in the sense that Blythe, at least here, seems to me to be very much down with the sort of the seriousness of the program. And there's a kind of intense engagement. His lines played against the brooding, as you call it, modalism of Tapscott. It's just kind of soaring and lovely. And it's not that he's doing anything particularly speedy or fast. Whenever this comes on, I sit up and pay attention. It's one of the few 17-minute songs. That's the title track. It's one of the few 17-minute songs that kind of holds me from beginning to end. It reminds me a little bit of Coltrane, obviously, except that Tapscott, you know, no diss to McCoy Tyner, but Tapscott just has something that McCoy Tyner doesn't. And Blythe seems a little less... You know how we talk about Coltrane sort of running through a brick wall again and again? Blythe seems a little less fraught in his engagement with these lines that Tapscott is laying out. Now, somewhere after the opening statements of that song, it kind of goes a little bit outside for a while. And Blythe seems adept at that, too. I mean, I think of him mostly as a kind of post-bop, mostly inside player. I don't think of him as like kind of an outside player, but Tapscott throws some curveballs, particularly in that title track, and it feels like Blythe is fine with them. You know, the moments I'm talking about where like the rhythm section kind of does kind of a freak out.
Yeah.
It happens a couple of times, and Blythe is just sort of there with that. Yeah, it's just fascinating. I can kind of listen to this album all day long. I am more taken with the title track than the other three tracks. I do like the other three tracks, but the title track is just something kind of, I don't know what to say about it. It's kind of march-like, but that's not quite right because that sounds a little too four square. And some of Blythe's lines are really soaring against that, the power of Tapscott and the rhythm section. It's also kind of interesting that the bass player and the drummer don't have a great deal to do here except keep good time, which they do. And the drama of the building background is really left to Tapscott and his increasingly ornate fingerings behind what Blythe is doing. And this is another good example of a song that sort of builds and releases tension in a really, really lovely way. I mean, it's just a masterpiece song, and I don't mean to just focus on the first cut only. It's just got that memorable kind of line running through it. It's kind of wonderful. Niger's theme, the closer, it seems to me Tapscott gets more of a chance to kind of stretch out here, and I don't know if he's just playing on a shitty piano or not, but I had intimations of Sun Ra at various points. I mean, I just don't think the piano is a great piano, or maybe it's not recorded well. I don't know what you thought about that, but it sounds like he's playing on an upright or something. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's Red Baron, the independent label that Bob Thiel or Thiel from Impulse put together. It's a very hard to track down. It doesn't seem to have found a corporate home. And right now, the CD reissue of that album is going for, you know, $100 and up. It was a sort of a tiny 1,000 print issue of that CD, came out a few years back. But if you're looking for the LP or the CD of it, it's pretty rare. We did a album by, I think it was it Reggie Workman, anyway, a bass player on that label. But it's just kind of an odd little operation he ran for a couple of years. So yeah, the production values are not up to an Impulse level or a Blue Note level. Well, Blue Note's got problems with pianos, but
right. At
least they're typically in tune. They just sound muffled as hell.
And there's at least one number where he drops out. I think it's Dark Tree. He drops out for, like, after the opening statement, Blythe doesn't play again until the final 30 seconds. So it really just turns into a Tapscott show. It's a trio song. Yeah. It's sort of in the middle. Nothing wrong with that. It's, you know, Tapscott is fascinating and endlessly inventive. So I kind of enjoy that song. It's just that Blythe isn't there very much on that third number. So yeah, I like this a great deal. But then I like Tapscott a great deal. And I guess I had heard this before and just didn't realize it was Arthur Blythe playing. And yeah, I really like him. He doesn't really live up to his last name, does he? You know, he's not a Blythe player. He's kind of intense without being... He strikes me as intense like Coltrane, but not in the way that, like, Coltrane seems sort of like sweating and fraught. And,
right.
You know, Blythe is just intense, but there's sort of pleasure or at least restraint in a way that one doesn't find with Coltrane, who's always so intense.
You're not happy-go-lucky, but yeah, more of a joyful player, someone who... And yeah, he's got... I think people will talk about... A few things I've noticed about him. One is he's got a distinctive wide vibrato. It is a little unusual in its speed and its width in the words that he's making. The variance of the note off pitch is greater than some people's vibratos. It's a very powerful sound, fills the horn up, and he likes the upper register. He will go up, and he's pretty powerful up there. And I guess the other thing that I noticed about his playing is I listened to several recordings by him, both ones we're doing on the show and a couple others I've got knocking around, is that he's ultimately not a real fast player. He does not do a lot of really flurrying runs. And every now and then he'll pull out a 16th note figure and he'll get a little quick, but that's not the way he builds intensity. He does not heat things up by playing faster. He might play higher. He's got kind of a piercing sound, and one reason when I was trying to pick another album to do by him, I was looking at In the Tradition, which came out the same year, might have been the first release, I'm not sure, as Lenox Avenue Breakdown. They're both 78 releases. And that one he does four standards and then two of his own compositions in a quartet, I believe. But that sound is just especially piercingly recorded for whatever, even the piano. I guess it's just the studio they're in or whatever. And I felt like, well, that one kind of pushed the envelope. And given your love of Jackie McLean, I didn't want to get you too upset. So I thought, well, maybe we should skip this one. Because it is a bit intense. And he can be intense in that sense. So yeah, I thought this was worth doing because there's so little Tapscott out there, period. I thought it's a pretty successful recording. And it's an oddity.
Yeah.
Someone, thank God, ripped and had up on the interwebs illegally, and I downloaded, because that and Bush Baby are both just kind of rarities right now. It's hard to find them legally in print. But, you know, fine recording, and Tapscott's in good form. Now, I read about that in this book, which I've not completed, but I've read bits and pieces of, called The Dark Tree. And the account there is, well, they were going to this recording session. They were in this beat-up old car that Horace owned. It broke down at least once. And then this guy's analysis was, well, this was them on a bad day. They play better than this most of the time. I'm thinking, well, Jesus Christ, if this was them at 40%, as the guy says, what were they like at 100? Because I think it's a pretty good record. So I it's kind of hard to imagine how much better they got. But apparently, at least according to this member of the collective who was talking about it, you know, for the book's author, this wasn't even them at their best. So obviously a pretty powerful group there.
Yeah.
But Horace was part of a large, again, community-based group that Tapscott ran for, I think, decades out of Los Angeles. Sometimes he'd have three drummers and four bass players on stage, and there was a whole choir apparently associated with it. It was very much, if you had the right heart and spirit, you were allowed to play. And there were some fantastic musicians there and some that would not have made the cut for Sun Ra or anybody else, you know, that were just kind of expressing themselves but weren't super talented musically. And it was not a kind of career or recording-oriented group as much as a kind of community-oriented thing. My cat is not impressed with my talking here. I may have to get up and let her out. I've shut the door because Bran's got some friends over. We've begun the period of open houses. Did you have open houses when people graduated?
My brother's stepdaughter, they do that. Yeah, that's a thing now. Everyone sends out little cards for open house and people come over and drop off gift cards. And yeah, it's a thing. We didn't do that, obviously, but my brother and I were musing on how strange it is to us, this whole new practice. Yeah,
it's definitely in force here in central Indiana. So his is coming up in a couple of weeks, and this is one of his circle of friends. So they're partying now that they no longer have to talk to the adults and shake hands and look at baby pictures. So it's very exciting for them. So anyway, yeah, I strongly recommend it. It's hard to pick up legally, but it may still out there be in some dark, dusty corner of the internet, and give it a listen. I think it's a fine record, and it kind of gives you a glimpse of Arthur several years before he comes out east and goes to New York. And when he gets to New York, he plays people like Gil Evans and is active in the loft scene. Makes a couple recordings on his own, and then he gets picked up by Columbia, which it's just hard to imagine now. One, kind of a major label, in a sense, is kind of hard to imagine now. I mean, they're kind of gone. I guess they're still groups, quote-unquote, with a push, but you tend to think of them more as artists building their own fan base through other means and then distributing themselves through a big label. I mean, I don't know, like, who does Taylor Swift record for? I don't even know.
Yeah.
Just you don't think of the star making machinery as belonging to a label, but at that time, yeah, you know, if Columbia picked you up and was pushing you through their jazz division, you had a kind of prominence and profile that most jazz musicians wouldn't have. And so he gets picked up and he ends up making 9 albums for Columbia. I've heard 4 of them. I keep my eyes peeled when I'm in the used bins because, needless to say, there are more copies of these records floating around than of many jazz releases. And I just feel like, for whatever reason, his reputation has been kind of marginal since that period. And I think part of it had to do with that Put Sunshine in It, like the quote-unquote sellout album. And you can ponder other reasons that might have been the case. But he just seems like somebody who's kind of neglected and has not gotten a lot of attention since that run with Columbia. And I picked probably the best-known recording and the best-reviewed, which is Lenox Avenue Breakdown. Is this one you'd listened to before, or is this something you had to focus on for here?
No, I hadn't. I don't think I had. I can't remember now if it was one of the ones. Actually, I can find out. I mean, 1 second, I'll tell you. No, this was new for me.
Okay.
What I had had before was I've had Spirits in the Field I've had for some time, and Illusions and Bush Baby. And in the tradition, Lenox Avenue Breakdown, Light Blue, those are all relatively new to me. I got In the Tradition earlier this year. Anyway, I love this album. I think as much as I like the Horace Tapscott, I think I might like this just a little better because the pleasure factor is enormous. I love this album. It is a load of fun. It's the kind of thing you can put on during dinner or you could have on while people were over and they could pay attention and go, oh, that's cool. Or they could also just let it slip into the background. Can't say enough about Bob Stewart's tuba. The tuba solo, the famous tuba solo.
Oh, yeah.
On the title song is ridiculous. Thank you. He is, and we've talked about him before because he's been on at least one or two other things we've talked about. I just can't get enough of him. I think he's a fantastic player. And yeah, the tuba solo on Lenox Avenue Breakdown is justly acclaimed. But more importantly, I think Down San Diego Way, the opener is brilliant. It just swings. It's peppy. It's got this sort of Latin tinge to it. And Blythe's extended soloing, that's an 8-minute song, is fantastic. And it's just joyful and fun. It is a great, great opener. And the instrumentation, the flute and the tuba together there are just wonderful. It's a really nice pairing. I love this album. I there's not a slow or bad cut on it. I think it's fantastic. And it's one of those cases where the reputation of the album as, you know, his masterpiece is pretty much justified. I like all the cuts. I think I like the first two the best. Lenox Avenue Breakdown, obviously for the tuba solo, but Down San Diego Way just for moment-to-moment pleasures. Wonderful. And another thing that's kind of interesting, all the cuts here are long, 8 to 13 and a half minutes. But it's all pretty much like major key bliss. This isn't fraught minor key, modal, depressed vamping. It's all peppy happy for the most part. I really enjoy it. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, I like it a lot. I think that it's a little problematic in that it has become, for a lot of people, the defining work and the only work you need to worry about from the Columbia years. And it probably is the strongest, but I don't feel like it's on a pinnacle apart from most of the things I've heard from him. I think that it's got a great personnel. In certain ways, like James Flood Ulmer gets one solo on the last number,
right,
but not a lot of space. And then I was thinking, you know, does James Newton solo on it? Well, he does, but I find that each one of these tunes is based on a pleasant, as you can say, kind of major key sounding riff. And they tend to be two chord vamps. They're not,
yep,
these are not complicated, knotty, multi-part suites. They are riffs. And then what happens is you set them up with these amazing textures, you know, the guitar, and it's a very unusual guitar. If you don't know James Blood Ulmer's work, he's got a very distinctive sound. He doesn't sound like anybody else, really. You've got this tuba thumping away. You've got Cecil McBee on bass, and I don't remember who the drummer is. He's there. He's fine. He doesn't have a lot to do, but, you know.
It's Jack DeJohnette.
He keeps going. Yeah, well, there you go. A major player. But, I mean, do you feel like this is an album where you notice him a lot? I mean, he's good, but he's probably got one good solo on there. But, I think if I concentrated on him, I say, well, what a good job you're doing, Jack. But it's not an album where there's right. a lot to listen to, again, because it's a vampy album. And then James Newton, a major voice on flute. But what happens is there are vamp songs, and then there are a string of solos with Blythe featured extensively on each one, and then other voices will come in. And
right.
then they wrap it up.
Yeah.
And they're very accomplished. I like it a lot. It's an amazing work. I think it's a mistake to kind of dismiss the rest of the Columbias. I think most of them are pretty good. It's only, again, I've got to hear Put Sunshine in one of these days so we can find out. What I remember as a kid seeing that record in bins everywhere. Because that was, I assume, towards the end of the tenure and some attempt to find a way to move more units. And what I think excited people about Lenox Avenue Breakdown was this idea that it was merging a somewhat accessible side of jazz, you know, right? It's riffy. It's not too minor key. It's happy-go-lucky. There's bouncing rhythms with the more avant wing. Some of the stuff gets kind of strange. James Blood Ulmer's always strange, and Blythe will go up there and squeal some. You know, he's not just trying to play pretty 24/7. And, of course, in a sense, it's what he's trying to do, just as his part of his career and musical identity, is this idea that you can wrap up jazz music from the 20s through the 70s and make an identity out of that you can include avant-garde elements in playing that is largely mainstream, but a little bit stranger than, you know, somebody from the 50s. It's not another Zoot Sims album. And we've talked about this before, how people like David Murray, it seemed like that would seem the way forward. You know, you don't give up what the 70s and 60s avant-garde guys were doing, but don't make that the whole story. Just make it another kind of arrow in your quiver. And yet the public clearly was not that interested in that approach. I mean, what they wanted was something a little bit more digestible, something with fewer rough edges. And so when Wynton emerges bright and young and shining in the early 80s, that's where all the gravity heads, and this approach gets marginalized. So yeah, in some ways, I think it's a kind of a monument to a really great attempt to make this kind of music work that still wasn't enough. It was still too hard, too thorny for the general record-buying public, and it did not push Blythe into kind of the commercial success that Columbia seems to have been looking for. That said, I think that some of his other records that I've heard, and I'm curious to hear the other ones, there's, needless to say, an album on Columbia called Blythe Spirit. Haven't got that one yet. Keep your eyes peeled for it. A number of records that he did there. And, you know, Illusions, I think, is from that period with two different groups. I think that's very good. I like the Monk album. I like this In the Tradition album. It's just kind of tonally hard. So
I was going to ask you before we get off of this album, you must own it, so tell us about the liner notes. They're by our old friend, the Hanging Judge, Stanley Crouch. Are they as wonderful as I expect?
Yeah, you know, I read them, and then I immediately had the whole Men in Black mind wipe so I could forget them the best I could. Yeah, I've had this for years on CD, and then I picked up a used copy from like a DJ or a library. You know, it was in pretty good shape. Most of the Blythe stuff, I think people bought them and then realized they'd gotten in a little bit deeper than they wanted to and didn't drop the needle on them again. Yeah, Crouch is this weird figure. We've talked about this before, where he comes out of the California scene championing people like David Murray and Arthur Blythe, and then kind of switches horses midstream and becomes the number one voice for Wynton Marsalis. Right. So, yeah, it's the usual bullshit, right? You know, poetic descriptions of the various musicians and a certain amount of kind of braggadocio about what they're doing to Western culture. You know, it's the usual stuff. I don't know that anything really struck me. It seemed less helpful than most liner notes, but that's typical for Stanley Crouch's stuff, right? But yeah, he is the shill man for this Avant Wing. You know, I haven't checked. I don't know. Maybe he even does some James Blood Omer notes. I don't know. I haven't looked. But, or Omer, maybe they figured was rock enough since he played electric guitar. They just didn't have that. I mean, it's more of a jazz thing to have liner notes than a rock thing. But yeah, it's they're not memorable. They are very Crouchly, though. Any other thoughts about nope. Lenox Avenue? And, of course, the cover is this very distinctive cityscape in a drawn style with a saxophone that is a building somehow. And I think kind of sums up what the record's about. You know, the major labels can afford these fancy artists. So if you run across it, definitely worth hearing. I'd say mainly to understand Blythe's art. I don't know that if you're a huge James Newton fan or James Blood Omer fan that you're going to get some of those artists, but maybe not as much as he thought. And I was wondering about Newton, whether it's just the way they balance the recording, that when he's soloing, he's definitely audible, but he's not quite featured. He's still right in the mix. And so it's very easy for my ear anyway, if I'm not just bearing down, to just kind of, it all becomes a level and a melange and just kind of goes on for a while. And then when Blythe comes back, you're not going to miss Blythe's entrance because he's, you know, very powerful. All right. Well, the other one we did from the Columbia period, and when I say we, I mean I'm the one who said, let's do these. And Mike's like, whatever, fine. Was Light Blue, which is Blythe's Thelonious Monk tribute. So this is a little bit unusual in the instrumentation. He's got another electric guitar player in there. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this guy. Yeah, Omer, he's not. And you don't like Omer much.
That's right.
But kind of a set of monk tunes. He doesn't do Round Midnight, right? He doesn't do the absolutely lowest hanging fruit.
He picks some oddballs. We see.
Yeah. And, it, you know, six tune set. I think after Lenox Avenue, he tends to make albums of about six tunes on Columbia. He decided that maybe 10 or 11 minutes was kind of pushing it. Six or eight was about ideal. And this is another one of those. So did you enjoy this particular? I mean, this is a subgenre of jazz. There must be hundreds of Thelonious Monk albums out there where Monk is the exclusive or the main composer. So this is another one.
So once again, Bob Stewart on tuba. So that's a big plus move right there. Happy about that. Yeah, the mixing here is a little weird. There's some extraneous percussion, a lot of tambourine jangling, some odd percussion. But Kelvin Bell, the guitarist, gets a lot of room to stretch out. I guess I would have rather have heard, it's going to be hard for me to say this, but I would have rather have heard James Blood Ulmer.
They give him a lot of rope, don't they?
They give him a lot of rope. And you know, if you're going to, I mean, was Ulmer not available? I mean, because this guy's like, okay, he's a good player, but he sounds like an Ulmer knockoff. And so I just kind of wonder why I wasn't the Blood in the room. It just seems a little weird. I also don't particularly like the interplay between Abdul Wadud, the cellist. He's a really fine player, but I don't like how the cello sounds against Bell's harmelotic fruity lines. Just something kind of tinker toy about some of that gets on my nerves. I don't know. I almost wish it was no guitar at all, or was just given a lot less space. That part, it's obviously not it's not a patch on Lenox Avenue Breakdown, but it's awfully good. It's pretty entertaining. It doesn't hold my attention consistently the same way. I think that a little bit of the air has gone out of the balloon. Lenox Avenue Breakdown is just, it's a lot of fun, but it's also intense and very serious. This seems more just fun. It's not light or frothy. For example, on Light Blue, the title cut, it's a pretty boozy imitation of Monk, and that's saying a lot since Monk's own playing on that song was pretty boozy. So it sounds like kind of like a drunk guy walking down the street, or maybe with the tuba it sounds like a drunk clown walking down the street. It's fun, it's enjoyable, but you know, it's not it doesn't seem to have quite the seriousness or the intensity of Lenox Avenue Breakdown. So I enjoy it. It's a 3.5-star album for me, whereas Lenox Avenue is 4, 4.5. You know, China's Awaken is like a 5-star album. You know, this isn't as good. It's enjoyable. Blythe's playing is fine. I just don't think the accompaniment is quite up to par on this, and it's a little less intense. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's not as demanding an album, and so my response is a little less enthusiastic as a result. It's enjoyable. It's a little bit better than enjoyable. That sounds like faint praise. It's a little bit better than enjoyable. But yeah, it doesn't have quite the level of engagement for me that Lenox Avenue Breakdown does. And man, they give that guitar a lot of room to run. I mean, especially like on Nutty. I'm like, really? We could have done with about 2 minutes less of this.
Yeah, he's playing kind of in an avant-garde style, but he just somehow doesn't project confidence or a kind of a musical certainty about what he's doing. It seems a little bit arbitrary.
Yeah.
And just a little bit, as you say, I kind of like the tinker toy or whatever you're calling it. There's just something a little silly about the way he sounds on it. So yeah, I'm not thrilled with his presence. This is more like a standard issue, you know, well, the whole genre, as I said, you know, the kind of, let's do an album of Thelonious Monk covers. I mean, how many musicians have done that? It's kind of a standard move, right? And he does pick some unusual ones. It's certainly unusual instrumentation with tuba and cello, but it's not as distinctive an album and probably not as successful. And you get the sense, I mean, this is 83, so he's been with Columbia 5 years. The relationship is starting to wind down. And one thing you get, especially with jazz musicians, is, you know, what is the context going to be? Especially if you're trying to make them, you know, if you're Steeplechase, you're like, how about another quartet of standards? You just, let's do that 17 times in a row. You just don't care. You're fine with that. But for a bigger label, they're trying to make some kind of occasion out of each recording. They want some kind of narrative to go with it. How do you sell it? What's different about it? What's distinctive? And you get the sense that they're flailing about a little bit here. How do they frame Blythe? How do they promote what he's doing? And I guess my experience with these albums has been having that narrative in my head of everything being kind of a cliff after Lenox Avenue Breakdown. I've been pleasantly surprised by the quality of what I've picked up on Columbia, because I really had not heard any of these other records I've got, which Illusions in the Tradition and this one, before, I guess, the last couple of years. But I would agree with you that none of them are quite at that level. They just, you know, they're successful jazz albums by, I think, an interesting artist, but they aren't quite, as you said, intense. And I'm sure there was some kind of turmoil going on with how they're going to present him. You know, how much pressure he got from producers, I don't know. But you kind of wonder, was this his idea or was it a Columbia exec's idea to say, well, let's do all Thelonious Monk covers. People know Thelonious Monk. Don't know. I think it came out pretty well. It's by no means a disaster. But why Bell is on guitar, again, I just don't have the answer for that.
Yeah.
The last recording I picked to do is kind of an oddity. It's one of a couple, quote-unquote, super groups that he got involved with. He's on a couple recordings by this group called The Leaders that included Chico Freeman and Lester Bowie and others. And then he was involved in this group called Roots, which also had Chico Freeman, had Sam Rivers in it, Don Pullen on piano. This is an album I ran across in Rockford, Illinois, some tiny punk-oriented record store and kit shop. You know, you could get a T-shirt that says, I love my mommy's tattoos for a baby, right? Why it was there? Why they purchased it? It was new? I don't know. It's like, I wonder if somebody went under and they got their stock, but I never heard of this before. And it's just kind of, I think, really pleasantly recorded album of standards by this group of guys that we tend to think of as, you know, left of center.
Yeah.
Inside-outside players. Not people who are just raw, absolutely 100% committed, atonal players, but people that go outside a lot and also touch base with the tradition, like a Chico Freeman or maybe more extremely a Sam Rivers. I mean, Sam I tend to think of as in the left part of that equation. And then another saxophone player who I think was kind of the straw boss and arranger, album called Stablemates.
Who's the organ player on this, by the way?
It's Don Pullen. So he plays both piano.
Oh, so when it's
organ.
Not piano, he's playing organ. Okay.
Yeah. And this is from 1992. So never heard of the bass player. Idris Muhammad on drums. He's pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
A couple German guitar players make cameo appearances. And then Nathan Davis is the other saxophone player, along with Chico Freeman and Sam Rivers and, of course, Arthur Blythe. The opening number of 9, Stolen Moments, features all 4 of the saxophone players on soprano playing the pretty well-known melody from that Oliver Nelson classic. There's some really rich saxophone ensemble playing here, and that's one thing I enjoy about the record. So I don't know if this is one you listened to before or not.
Nope, brand new to me, and I like this quite a bit. to me, it sounds a lot like, believe it or not, a mellow world saxophone quartet album with piano rhythm accompaniment or organ in some cases. They never really go Rivers and Pollan are on their best behavior here. And so this is mostly straightforward bop. Some of it is just sort of R&B almost, but it reminds me a lot with some of the unison playing of World Saxophone Quartet, which is interesting since Blythe replaced Julius Hemphill after he passed, or maybe before he passed.
He was briefly there. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was part of WSQ for a while, maybe on the strength of this, you know, showing, you know, he can play with players as difficult as Pollan. So not as Pollan, as difficult as Rivers. Rivers was a challenging guy. So I enjoyed this. It was surprisingly much more in than I would have expected it to be. And a lot more unison playing. That opener, as you pointed out, it's a pretty good example.
Yeah,
there's everyone gets a little bit of there's a little bit of freaking out soloing, but a lot of just sort of sweet harmonic arrangements of these guys playing together. Very pleasant album, much more low key than I would have thought. I would have expected this to be a kind of a much more out there date given the personnel, and it's not. Very pleasant album. I didn't think it was super challenging, but I didn't think that was the point. These guys, if they wanted to challenge you, obviously can't do that. This is a set of personnel who can go to town if they want to. Everyone's sort of got their soft slippers on and they've got a nice beverage, adult beverage by their side. They're playing a nice, easy date and they mesh well. It's a really good set of pairings here. And again, it's a little surprising because Rivers is something of a wild card. And so is Pollan. Pollan does stretch out a couple times, but not nearly as far as he can go. You know, he can go all Cecil Taylor for, you know, 3 minutes at a time. And that never happens here. So, yeah, I found this was just really the word that comes to mind the most for me when I listen to this is pleasant. And I don't mean that in a damning with faint praise way. It's not a challenging album. It's just a pleasant one. It's very enjoyable, very mellow, very almost easy listening. I liked it quite a bit. I might actually have liked it a little bit better than Light Blue, which is a little too occasionally humorous to quite sail under the notice. You know, there's times on Light Blue where you're sort of your attention is drawn to it, whereas this is just kind of like groovy, man. Take out the bongos, put on the shades and the beret and just kind of kick it. So yeah, I like this a lot. It's not my favorite of the four, but it's awfully good. I would be hard-pressed to tell the players apart since Blythe here isn't really playing with a lot of his most obvious characteristics, except for when he solos, because the unison playing is actually quite tight. So it's not like everyone's standing out when they're doing the sort of unison lines.
Right.
Is Rivers playing tenor here, or is he on alto?
They're playing multiple horns depending on the tune. So again, they all will play soprano. He is listed for tenor and soprano.
Okay.
Whereas Chico, Nathan, and Arthur all play alto. And Chico and Nathan also play tenor. So Arthur never plays tenor, and Sam never plays alto, and they all play soprano.
Freeman's a different enough player from Rivers that I think I can tell them apart, except that would only be on the solo passages, not on any of the unison passages. They're actually, everyone's, you know, staying within their lane, so you can't really tell what's going on.
Yeah, but they're distinctive enough that there isn't a blandness or a sense that it's so homogenous. It's just kind of like a presetting on a synthesizer.
That's exactly right.
There's enough character there, not maybe as much as you might get from Allington's section, but kind of veering that way that there's enough personality in the ensemble playing that it doesn't just seem bland or just competent. It seems like more than that. And it's amazingly, the recording itself is kind of a thing of rich, mellow beauty, right? Whatever In and Out Records, wherever their studio is based, and it apparently in Heidelberg, the Germans record very nicely. It's just got a sound of kind of a mellow, rich sound that is very easy on the ear.
Yeah, as I said, it's when they solo you can tell them apart. And I mean, I think it's Blythe who has the opening alto solo on George, We Hardly Knew Ya. And that's just lush. That's rapturously beautiful. And that's not a word I normally think of with Blythe. I mean, I don't think of him as a balladeer, but that's just really pretty.
That is, when you look at Blythe's discography, you don't find a lot of traditional ballads. Yeah, he's not somebody that necessarily has a slow, aching feature on his recordings.
Right.
And so, yeah, it is interesting to hear him. And he does play gorgeously. I think it's great.
That kind of struck me on this. And yeah, that number in particular, I could really sort of relish his playing. He gets in a sort of extended workout at the opening of that song. So, yeah, it's just really pleasant. I really enjoyed this disc a lot. I'd probably place it third of the four. I guess I would go, not that you asked, but I would go The Giant Is Awakened, real neck and neck with Lenox Avenue Breakdown, and then this third and the Monk disc fourth. But they're all good. Like,
yeah,
fans should own all four of these. There's no excuse not for having any. There's no excuse not to have any of these if you like good jazz. It's just that The Giant Is Awakened is really hard to find. So
right, it is. It's tricky. As Blythe stuff has been, though, again, I've got some hope that now if you're somebody who purchases it, and I just don't know what the streaming situation is on his stuff, that you can at least get a budget price CD reissue of some of his major albums from Columbia now, which is neat because, again, it's kind of heartbreaking to see. Whatever you want to call this stuff, I think it's of an adequate quality to be in print, for God's sakes. I mean, there's so much stuff out there that is circulating, and it's great that 50 of Eddie Lockjaw Davis's albums are in print, but if you might be able to make it with 48 of them and have a couple more Blythe albums. So it's good to see that those are coming back. But again, just an artist who was on a major who then just deserted and forgot him and has not kept him in circulation. So this is a neat one. It's, again, a complete bizarro find. And I found some either a really odd homage to Charlie Parker album that's much more avant-garde there at another visit. And I don't know. I have not been there for years, but where they're getting their records, why they have these mint condition, or really brand new records of kind of left of center recording artists in amongst their old George Shearing and Michael Franks
right.
used LPs. It's like, what the fuck are these doing here? How do they appear? And this, I always find it kind of a neat album, delightful to listen to. Again, it's a weird sense, and I kind of became a little interested in this phenomena of these super groups where you get musicians who don't quite have the reputation as leaders to necessarily always carry a career, but are very fine players and have their own ideas and personalities and are distinctive, and then they band together. And so I was thinking, yeah, we've got this group, this other group that he was in, the Leaders. SF Jazz Collective would be a recent illustration of this, or the Cookers, who I saw a few months back. It, you know, both of those are the same kind of deal where you get guys like a Billy Harper who can play pretty but has some freer tendencies. You band them together and you try to put together a package that maybe will be stronger than sales-wise its component parts. But the interest for somebody who's really into the music is, my God, I know most of these people and I want it. What will they be like together? It's kind of like an all-star package, but again, only for people that really know jazz. Otherwise, the difficulty is no one name is so big that it's just, so I don't know how successful these ever turn out to be commercially. I think SF Jazz Collective, their intelligent move has been to get kind of a institutional profile, a kind of funding and a home and I'm assuming grants that kind of sustain them as opposed to being trying to purely commercial enterprise.
Right.
But
right.
Yeah, for whatever reason, Blythe was in a couple of these. And I guess it's that guy that's name was well enough known that you know, he gets a little commercial cachet. And, of course, he's a serious artist. He's a good player. And then you kind of bundle him up with these other people. So, yeah, a real oddity. Yeah, Sam does not get too wild. I did notice when the piano came in, even the more traditional stuff, is like, man, that guy's hitting the keys really hard. Oh, yeah, it's Don Pullen.
Yep, it's you know, Don Pullen.
He's striking them pretty good. Yeah, he's not showing any mercy there. But
no.
Yeah, really neat record. It almost encapsulates this idea that there's this generation of people that are trying to say, look, we never forgot the tradition. We've always been interested in it. We're not trying to desert it. It's just we also have listened to Albert Ayler.
Right.
And where's our home? And it just that would have seemed to be the next natural step in the 70s and 80s, a kind of merging or, you know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, right? If Heidegger was in charge of jazz history. And these were the synthesis guys. And then this weird left or rather right flank kind of took things over and said, no, everything after 1960 is bad and we're going to reproduce it and we're really young and we look great in suits.
Right.
And that's not entirely fair, but that became the face of, and we're not going to play a single note that is not in the accepted harmonies, right? We're never going to get out too far. We're never going to scare you. and we're always going to be immaculately recorded as well as immaculately dressed. And there's a lot of interest going on there. I mean, I think some of Wenton's early stuff is fine, but it's never going to intrude itself upon you. You can safely put it in the background and ignore it. If you listen, you'll get something more out of it. But there's never going to be that moment where you're kind of, your spine shudders and like, man, that was, what was that? You know, when Blythe goes way up in the altissimo register and kind of shocks you awake. We're not going to have any of that. So that's one reason this guy fascinates me. I got to say, after listening to this, I don't know that I'm convinced that Blythe was, he was a really interesting leader. I don't know that he was a gifted leader. I don't know that he found ensembles, other than with the exception of Bob Stewart, who of course gets a great show place in some of his recordings, that kind of were larger than themselves or discovered artists who were going to go on to their own careers. I just don't know that I think of him as a mastermind for putting a group together. Like his groups, but, and they're interesting and they're distinctive, but he doesn't seem to have found a way that, that was influential on other people or, again, discovered musicians. I think that the Stewart, it makes sense because, again, Blythe is not the super fast player, and those registers play brilliantly against each other. You know, with that kind of thumping tuba background, his alto cuts through that beautifully. And so that works really well. And again, as a soloist, I like him a lot, and I think he's got the gift for me that's, you know, really important in a jazz musician, that he's distinctive, right? He's got this voice. And I think the more you hear him, the more, you know, that vibrato, and again, the kind of, he's not a real minor player. He doesn't tend to be a super introspective player, but he's got a huge life force, a huge sound. You know, I thought of him a little bit, despite the lack of ballads and whatever, as maybe his generation's Johnny Hodges. If you think of Hodges as somebody whose first and greatest gift was tone, I don't know. Hodges was never Mr. Fast. He was never somebody who just ripped it up. He was somebody who crafted lines and had this amazing tone. And I don't think Blythe sounds like him, but for me, Blythe's greatest gift is this amazing, very different, but super ripe, super focused, super powerful tone with a cry in it. And again, I don't know that Blythe is a super gifted composer, and he's not necessarily, I think, somebody who had a ongoing vision. And it's hard to say whether he would have blossomed under, you know, if he'd found some kind of mid-tier label that was more willing to nurture him and less worried about sales, maybe he would have developed further. It's hard to say. But of course, when he comes out to New York, he's in his 30s, right? He's born 1940. So by the time he starts cutting sides for Columbia, he's nearing 40. Nothing wrong with that, but he was pretty developed at that point. He didn't have, you know, he found himself back in California in the 60s. So it was, you're not listening to an artist who's like reinventing himself as he goes. You know, the fifth album on Columbia is not a revelation compared to the first one. So that's kind of my long meandering rant about him. We've listened to a lot of David Murray over the years. What do you think of Blythe in comparison with him?
He's much more pleasant, and he's much less serious, which isn't to say that Murray isn't pleasant or that Blythe isn't serious. It's just that Murray is much more serious and Blythe is much more enjoyable. Murray strikes me as a kind of, he's serious. He's kind of a musician's musician. And unless he's doing, unless, you know, on some of those albums where he does some of the sort of the Creole or Caribbean, you know, Latin tinged stuff, on those albums, he kind of lets his hair down a little bit. But otherwise, Murray seems like a very serious inside outside player with, you know, a tone as big as a house. And Blythe is much more, he's more accessible. He's more pleasant. He's very craftsmanlike. He's very smart about the way he puts his lines together. They're very pretty, and there's a kind of progression to them. And he knows how to sort of build and release tension. I don't think anyone really compares favorably to David Murray just in terms of power. Murray's just, he's just got a big, big sound. There's very few contemporary players who are quite like that. I'd maybe put David S. Ware in that category. A couple other guys who are just, they can sort of blow the doors off of a room Blythe isn't that guy, but he's not light or frothy. This isn't Paul Desmond, you know. This is someone with a good deal more oomph. He's not light the way, say, Desmond is, or some of the other more fleet alto players are. You know, there's a kind of he brings maybe one way of thinking of it is he brings the kind of seriousness of the power tenor player to the alto, but without the po-faced anguish of a Coltrane or the blank seriousness of a Murray in his more Mandarin-like moods. Maybe that's one way of putting it.
Yeah, Blythe's solos are a lot more legible, right? They make sense. You can follow them. Where Murray sometimes will just go into a huge flurry of notes or altissimo craziness. He's obviously got some Eiler in his blood. And I don't know that... Yeah, Blythe, he's definitely got some avant-garde leanings, but he is not committed to the purely atonal freak out in the way that Murray can be. At the same time, I think Murray's at his best, you know, like with the octet, a more important composer, arranger, leader than Blythe is. And he's just probably, technically speaking, I think a more amazing saxophone player. You know, I listen to Blythe, I think he's got amazing tone. He's got a great altissimo, but he doesn't just blow me away technically in the way Murray does. That said, his records can be a lot more consistent. And of course, the other thing to look at them is career-wise, Blythe goes from being in this almost cult with Tapscott. And Tapscott's kind of like Sun Ra, except they don't record as much. You know, it's this weird, almost communal thing. But more, I think, you know, Ra is kind of finally out of a commercial background. He's used to gigging. He's used to recording. He's very, very odd, but he's a working musician. I don't think Ra is trying to create a community outside of his group. And he's not trying to improve the culture around him. Maybe he's trying to introduce it to space. But you know, he's in some ways, he's a band leader with roots. And Tapscott, it seemed more really committed to just making Los Angeles better culturally and spiritually and politically as much as he was to music. I mean, music was a vehicle for that. And he thought about music incessantly, but he wasn't, you know, he wasn't worried about a career as a musician. And so Blythe gets out of that, and then he goes to Columbia, and he makes 9 records, or as David Murray would call that, Saturday. And then, he makes a couple records in Savant towards the end of his, you know, early 2000s. But, yeah, he doesn't have that kind of prolific drive. Murray never really quite goes to the majors, but he's just always finding another home that's going to put his stuff out. He does half a dozen albums for Red Baron, and then he does... God, a couple dozen for Black Saint and DIW. And he's just, you know, he's a working guy. He's in major groups. He just really seems more driven. So I tend to think of them maybe as saxophone-wise, at least the major exponents of this mixing of the avant-garde and the tradition. I mean, both of them, to some degree, I think sound-wise, look for models from the 30s, right? You feel like David Murray's listened to John Coltrane, or not only John Coltrane, but people like Coleman Hawkins, right? And I do feel like Blythe at some level, and he not just listened to Charlie Parker, I think he listened to people like Johnny Hodges, or whoever the lead alto player was in the Basie band, or just, you know, players from the 30s, maybe even a little Benny Carter. You know, there's a little Benny Carter there, maybe. Fascinating figure for that reason. And again, I tend to think of it as a lost generation. It's just that Murray refused to be lost. He's like, I don't give a shit. I'm just going to keep putting records out. I've got alimony payments to make, bitch. You know, I'm going to keep going. Similar but different. And they don't... I'd be fascinated to find out how Blythe's tenure in the World Sax Quartet worked. It was apparently short. I just don't know. Whatever the case was, it was not a long-lived thing. He did not apparently fit into that culture that well, because it was very brief. The great untold stories of 80s progressive jazz. All right. Thank you for bearing with me on that. Are you ready for a brief round of the Mike Sightment meter?
Sure.
This is where I tell you about records I picked up, and I try to guess your level of excitement from 1 to 10.
Yes.
I think you told me 1 to 5 was not divided enough to measure how thrilled you might be. All right, so some of these are recurring artists, and I'll just have to do my best. I found yet another Joanne Braqueen trio album, also with Eddie Gomez, Special Identity. I know you like Joanne. I love Joanne. I like this one especially well. Do you have a number written down?
No, wait. What am I? I'm writing down my excitement or
your excitement. It's the excitement. Oh, my excitement. How excited you are. I'm going to guess how excited you are about Joanne.
I have a number written down, yes.
I'm going to guess 9.
Close. I guessed 8.
Okay. Well, it's good. You really are. You're excited 9. You just don't know it.
I've only listened to it once or twice, so I have to give it a couple more spins. But she's always fun.
Yeah, I think it's, for whatever reason, it just seems like one of the more immediately pleasurable of her releases. I'm not sure why, but I was happy to find that, and I always think those are fun. All right, here's a guy more up my alley than yours. From the early 1970s, after the quartet broke up, Dave Brubeck with Jerry Mulligan, an album called Blues Roots.
Dave Brubeck with Jerry Mulligan, Blues Roots. Okay, go ahead.
I'm going to guess 6.
No, 7.
Oh, so close, so close.
I like Mulligan. I like that Mulligan. Is it Mulligan and Brubeck? Afternoon, Flight of a whatever. It's the Desmond Mulligan. There's Desmond Mulligan duo date. What the hell is that called?
Oh, Two of a Mind.
Two of a Mind. I really like that.
Oh, that's one of my favorite records of all time. That was one of the first ones I had as a kid, and that's for me. That is the cool jazz testament.
I think there's a song in there called Blight of the Fumblebee, which is just brilliant. Mulligan of Barry Players, he's fleet enough for cool jazz, you know? Sometimes you think of Barry Players as, you know, a little more ponderous, but yeah, he's got that thing. So I'd give that a 7. I like that.
And it's Brubeck, I picked this up and I put a blog post about it with a live album I did with a quartet called Jackpot from Las Vegas from like the late 60s. And by that point, Columbia's really pushing the product out. The piano's out of tune. Desmond only plays on half the numbers. It's just not very inspiring. And I do get a sense from the early 70s that Brubeck feels a bit freed up. He was getting tired of the quartet formula. And so once that group broke up, a little bit more energetic, a little bit more inventive. That's the period where he makes that album with Anthony
Is he
Braxton.
Still alive?
No. Brubeck is gone. Yeah, we did okay. an album. We did a show dedicated to him after he passed. And Mulligan's
I totally
long
forgot
gone.
That. Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, Brubeck was like 100, wasn't he? He made it to like 100.
He was up there. But anyway, so this is it's an album of blues songs by a couple of white guys and a pretty good rhythm section. And it's pretty successful, pretty energetic. There is some pounding. There's no way around it, but
that's
I think
Dave.
Overall it's a good album. Yeah, Dave will get a little bit poundy. Okay, Jan Garbarek, Witchy Tie Toe.
Witchy Tie Toe, Jan Garbarek from the 70s, huh? But I see that it's with Bobo Stenson, so that's interesting. All right, so I have a number on this. Go ahead.
Is it 8?
7. It was going to be 2, but then I saw Bobo Stenson was part of this quartet, and I have a big Bobo Stenson hard on. So apparently he played a whole bunch with Bobo and some of the other stalwarts of the avant Euro jazz world, but I think Bobo Stenson is a genius.
All Music says that this, along with Conference of the Birds, is one of the two finest jazz albums ECM ever released.
Wow. Okay.
So they've got a big hard on for it. I think it is excellent. I don't know if it's quite that good, but it's very damn good. So yeah,
okay.
It's surprisingly great. Strongly recommended. I've been, going back and getting those 70s and 80s ECM stuff, which I actually like. And then finally, Charles McPherson, McPherson's Mood.
yeah, you hooked me up with this. So yeah, I've got a number here. Go ahead.
7?
No, I'm pretty much interested in anything Charles has to play these days. So I'd love to become a. He's one of the few jazz players who I personally know. So right. Yeah, I've just about anything by him, a 9 or a 10, just because it's like I can see I know that person, you know, and I can sort of put the playing together with meeting him and talking to him about jazz. So yeah, and you hooked me up with that, and I do like that album. My interest before just hearing, you could just pencil me in for a 9 or a 10 pretty much on any McPherson album. But on listening to it, I thought that was pretty good. Actually, I enjoyed it quite a bit.
And so. I like it too. Yeah, I was trying to guess your number. I'd probably give it an 8. I mean, I like it. I think it's Barry Harris is on it. It's bebop, but he does do, it's My Sharia Moore. So he does a Stevie Wonder tune.
Right.
And McPherson's Mood is a nod to Parker's Mood. It's a blues performance.
Right.
Yeah, it's just a very good, very solid kind of bop, hard bop recording from 69. But it's a good one. So another one, I think maybe my favorite of his that I've heard so far. It's likable.
All right.
I've enjoyed it. Okay, any pop matters to bring up?
'Cause I'm like you. Yeah, I like you. Feel it's a bohemian like you. Yeah, I like you. Yeah, I like you. And I feel, whoa, whoa.
A bunch of new stuff. Nothing's really taken too much to this point, apart from the only one that you'd be interested in, I think, is the 2016 release by the Pretenders, Alone, which just goes to show that Chrissy Hynde still has it. She never lost it, but you know, it's kind of weird sometimes when bands or particular pop players pass their sell-by date. It's because they've stopped being interesting. I think of Jeff Tweedy and Wilco, right? But even though I'll just sink with that ship, I'll just keep getting their discs until they stop making them. But in her case, it's just, you know, maybe people stop paying attention, but Jesus God Almighty, she's good. The band is, of course, terrific. So I'm if they're selling stock in that album, I'm buying. I think it's fantastic. So that was from 2016. I did pick up something that I just want to mention to you, not because it's good or bad. I've only given it one listen, but just because the cover is amazing. Chick Corea's Vigil from 2014. And you should just Google that now, sports fans. Chick Corea. The name of the album is Vigil, V-I-G-I-L. Yes, I'm waiting for the reaction. Reaction?
Yeah, I'm trying to get a... Oh, my Lord.
I mean, really? It doesn't play like that. Let's put it this way. That cover, that's a 2014 release, and with song titles like Outside of Space, Pledge for Peace, Portals to Forever, Planet Chia, Galaxy 32, Star 4, and the cover with Chick Corea in, I think it's a suit of armor, and he's got a lance. I think he's supposed to be Don Quixote riding a really enormous charger. I mean, this is straight out of 70s spacey fusion Return to Forever bullshit. And I couldn't believe it when I got the cover of this. I'm like, what the fuck? And I thought, I'm going to hate this. And then I played it, and it's actually not like that at all. Even though the cover and the titles promise one thing, the album delivers a different. But yeah, isn't that an amazing cover? Have you ever seen? It's like him in a, it's a sort of an oil painting of Chick Corea astride a charger, wearing a suit of armor, carrying a lance.
But the palette's not, kind of ignore. I mean, like the horse is a really unhealthy kind of green, and there's these nasty reds and oranges. It's kind of horrific. Yeah,
isn't that an amazing cover? And he on the horse, Chick on the horse, looks very serious. This isn't ironic. which is why it reminded me of, like, you know, Return to Forever, because it looks so fucking serious. But the playing itself isn't Return to Forever, thank God. Although there are a couple of 17-minute songs on the album, so make of that what you will. I know. But it's better than the cover. But I mean, I saw, like, I picked it up and I'm like, oh no, I'm not going to like this. But it's better than I thought. But I, you know, just for the cover alone, it deserves attention.
Of some kind. Maybe from the Police. Yeah.
I think, can you believe that's a 2014 album cover?
Or any decade.
I know, but that's like a 70s rock cover or a 70s fusion cover. That's from 35 years ago. When you look at that cover, you're like, oh, yeah, my dad had this. I saw it in the garage. No, he didn't. It came out 2 years ago.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. It's stuff like that I really have been listening to Korea more in the last 5 to 10 years than I did before. And I think it's because of early exposure to things like Return to Forever.
Right.
And I just kind of put him on my don't listen to list. And he's talented. I like a lot of his playing, but there are times he just goes into weird corridors that I do not want to follow him down. And it took a while to kind of realize that despite that, there was a lot of substance. I picked up another LP reissue I got was a Blue Note Brown reissue from, I think, the 70s or 80s, a double album of stuff they hadn't released called Circling In, which is really quite interesting. And some of it is pretty avant-garde. Some of it's more straight-ahead trio playing. A lot of it, some of it has, you know, Dave Holland on it. And is it Barry Altschul, the percussion player?
Yeah.
And a little Sam Rivers. But then other things are more traditional trios. And it's really fine music from like the late 60s, early 70s. So there's a lot of great Chick Corea out there. It's just you look at something like this and you don't want to look the guy up for another 10 years. I mean, I may have to crawl under the covers after seeing this. It's just kind of...
The album itself is a kind of fusion-y thing, but it's not bad. The opener is extremely fusion land, but then this is sort of like the parts of fusion that you liked, you know?
Okay.
Because the playing is actually pretty good. It's got other players on it, unfortunately... The wife sings on one of the songs.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I know. But Stanley Clark is here on bass, and Ravi Coltrane is on saxophone on one of the songs. The band includes a guitarist who also plays acoustic. And the acoustic guitar he plays on a couple of numbers I really like. And Tim Garland plays the winds. I don't know him at all, but he plays bass clarinet, which is always a win. And then flute, soprano and tenor. So it's an interesting album. You know, it looks like fusion, and when you first play it, you're like, oh no, we've been here. But it's less so once you get past Chick playing electric piano. It's actually got pretty high jazz content, and he also plays acoustic piano along with electric on the same song sometimes.
Okay.
Which, yeah, make of that what you will. It's interesting. So it's yeah. Apparently, it did really well on the jazz album charts in 2014. According to the internet, it peaked at number 4, which tells you that jazz listeners are all middle-aged people yearning for the 70s, I guess. I don't know.
Mostly colorblind, it turns out. I didn't know that.
Yes.
But, ooh, yeah. What a cover. Well, of course.
So, yeah, you might actually like this. It's not... It gets better as it goes, which is interesting to me.
You know, I by no means hate all fusion, as we know from the Weather Report debacle. And I, you know, I've been listening. I picked up another Joe Farrell LP. I've got almost his whole run on CTI, Moon Germs. And that is just, boy, that's delightful to listen to. He may be my favorite soprano saxophone player. I'm not sure, but he's at least in the running. He is so good on that horn. Sounds so good. Not sugary, but not out of tune. Do you have any more, or should I jump in?
No, you can jump in. Go ahead.
So I got a couple old things. I don't have anything new. I've got something queued up that I'm hoping to listen to in the next few weeks. But the old tip, listen to Paul Thorne, Mission Temple Fireworks Stand.
When you're born, it's a beautiful thing. They put a pacifier in your mouth. You crawl around naked on the kitchen floor, and your mom and daddy feel so proud. Everybody looks good,
looks good
at the starting line. Get on your mark, get ready, but you better keep this in mind.
I guess it's not an ancient recording. We saw him in Lafayette, Joyce and I did a Friends of Bob concert. And you may never have heard him, but if I say that he's WXRT rock, you know what I mean. You know, white guy, kind of bluesy background, fine band, not super ambitious, decent souled kind of gravelly singer, decent imagery. I don't know if XRT's ever played him, but they should. He would fit right in there. And the song that we know best from him is Everybody Looks Good at the Starting Line. He talks about how adorable we are, all are as babies, and then how difficult it is to keep it up over the decades. But it's kind of an album that has some spiritual themes in it and obviously some secular ones. But it's that kind of, he's good, he's better than good. The band is tight and forceful. But it's just kind of, it's not super ambitious, and it's a white guy with some gospel, I don't know, good old-fashioned rock and roll leanings, and boy, he would fit right there on an XRT playlist.
Interesting.
Yeah, and we liked him when we saw him live. He's got, you know, good charisma. He's one of those B-rank troubadours who's going to have a really solid career, but is probably never going to be a superstar. And it's kind of playing in the idiom, in the tradition. He's not trying to innovate, but he's got his own piece to say, and he says it. And then I picked up, for one penny plus shipping, 13 Tales from Urban Bohemia by the Dandy Warhols. I felt that I needed something.
Oh, yeah, I like that album. It's a good album.
Yeah, it wasn't pieced together from Napster. I listened to them in the Napster era. I think I decided that they are the urge overkill of their day, in that a band that most critics kind of hated because they weren't quite that serious and they acted like rock stars. They had actual talent. I think it's quite a strong record,
yeah.
But not a well-loved group critically.
No.
And then obviously one that didn't sustain a real long career. And you can now buy their best known record for a penny. Yeah, I like that record a lot. The best known tune was Bohemian Like You, which takes the Brown Sugar Rolling Stones riff and just steals it very happily. But a lot of good tunes on there. I think at one point they're stealing George Harrison's guitar riff from My Sweet Lord. You know, they kind of steal here, steal there.
That's okay, because he stole it from the Shangri-Las.
Yeah. Exactly.
I
mean, and there's...
The lyrics are sometimes quite inspired. Bohemian Like You is a great song.
Yeah, it is. It's really a lot of fun. Horse Pills is misogynistic, but quite effective and funny. Yeah, it's a group that uses a fair amount of humor. It's hard to know how seriously to take them. Again, it reminds me a bit of Urge Overkill. They're enjoying playing in idioms that came before. They're very good at them. They're very cocky, a lot of swagger. And it's just kind of a pretty solid record from beginning to end. But, you know, I had the previous record, which is a lot more droney. The best-known song of that was Not If You Were the Last Junkie on Earth.
Yeah.
With the chorus, I never
love that song. Yeah,
never thought you'd be a junkie because heroin's so passe. Yeah, it is an amazing tune, but that record overall does not sustain interest the way 13 Tales does. And then I think
there's some really good songs on that. Cool as Kim Deal is brilliant, and so is Minnesota. I love Minnesota.
Yeah.
That's a great song.
Yeah.
Of course, if you were living in Minnesota when that came out, or near there, as I was, or at least now was, but I heard it not long after that. I was like, oh, yeah, this is hilarious.
Yeah, they're not quite doing for Minnesota what Sufjan Stevens did for Illinois, but...
No, not at all.
Very sarcastic bastards. But yeah, a fun record. So if you've got a penny and then shipping, it's worth hearing. It's probably streaming somewhere. So that's what I've been listening to. That's the end of the story.
End of your story. It's a good story.
It is. That concludes episode 117 of the Jazz Bastard Podcast. Thanks so much for your suggestions as to upcoming content for the cast. As always, it takes a while to get the wheels in motion. It'll be a month or two before we can get all that content up. We hope to do so in a timely fashion. We're still very much open to suggestions. You can contact us at pat@jazzbastard.com and mike@jazzbastard.com with all of your podcast suggestions, or on our Facebook page. You can download the podcast from www.jazzbastard.com or from iTunes. Tune in next time as Pat and Mike sit in the same room and talk about John Pizzarelli, Sun Ra, Jack DeJohnette, and and a Branford Marsalis collaboration with Kurt Elling. Until next time, take care.